Hello again, listeners, as we begin the last of a three-part series with Seth Klein. Seth Klein is director of Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives here in BC. He has graciously agreed to share his knowledge and opinion on a number of policy issues, such as austerity, taxation, and inequality in BC, Canada, and abroad. This week, we're going to focus in on inequality and its consequences for the economy and society. Hello again, Seth.
Hi.
We have discussed on our show a number of times inequality in the Occupy movement. Many people have commented that the Occupy movement or the 99% has no point. I think the point is the intersection of economics and political inequality. First, I have read that we have the most productive economy in history, Western society, that barring, of course, the slight downturn we've taken during this current recession, we make more stuff and there's more money out there than there ever has in history. Is this true?
Well, society, I think overall, economies of wealth are growing. But if you look at economic performance, there's no great mystery to this. If you were to look at the 30-year period after World War II, what you might call the Keynesian economic period, and compare it to the neoliberal economic period from the mid-70s to more recently, that earlier Keynesian period saw much, much stronger economic performance, but the gains of that were shared more equally.
Well, that leads into my next thing, because I've also read with regards to purchasing power that the 90% of the working class essentially have actually lost ground over the last 30 or 40 years, that for the first time in sort of the industrial age, that might be a bit broad, but the next generation will be worse off than the current generation.
I think it's a bit more complicated than that. It doesn't quite work when you talk about the 90 or the 99%. The work that we've done over the years that in particular looks at families with children, that the bottom 40% of those families has actually seen a deterioration in their household income, adjusted for inflation, even though those families are better educated and have dual earners compared to a generation earlier. So here you have families that are working smarter and working harder and falling further behind. With others, there is an increase in their absolute income, but even there, an explosion in inequality. So it's really only if you look back on the last 20 years, for example, it's only the richest 20% of Canadians who saw an increase in their share of overall income. Everybody else saw a decline. And you might say, well, oh, but that's only relative. Everyone, you know, a rising tide still lifts all boats. But those relative differences still make people worse off in significant ways. First of all, when you get particularly the wealthiest 1% pulling away from the pack, they're causing affordability problems for people down the income chain, if you will, particularly on the housing front. Their wealth is making housing costs more expensive for everybody. But we also know that more unequal societies, and this is, I'm drawing now on really the really important work of British epidemiologists Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, and their work in a book called The Spirit Level. The more inequality there is in a society, there's all kinds of social and health consequences and costs that are borne by everybody, ironically, even the 1%.
Although things may have increased to a certain degree, that not all economic levels have gained or suffered equally based on both the boom and the current recession / depression we're in right now.
Yeah, well, you've always got to be careful with overall averages. They don't tell you very much. They're not particularly revealing. And certainly what we know in our own society is, again, you know, you might, let me just take, for example, the poorest 20%. So did they see an increase in their income over the last 20 years? Yes, they did, but it was tiny, you know, a couple thousand dollars a year over 20 years. But if you looked at only the bottom 5%, you would find that their incomes have actually declined, the poorest 5%, because of minimum wages being frozen and welfare rates being frozen and things like that.
As our listeners know, I'm certainly no big fan of capitalism or its ugly offspring corporatism, but the reality is we do live in a capitalist society. So isn't inequality a necessary part of capitalism?
There's always been inequality in capitalism, but not like this. And in fact, economic performance has been stronger when inequality was more contained. So for example, if you compare, as Armin Yalnızyan has done, one of our national senior economists, if you look at something I mentioned earlier, a third of all income growth in the in the 10 years leading up to the recession went to the wealthiest 1%. Well, it didn't always used to be like that. If you look at the 1950s and 60s, when the economy was also growing very quickly, no one would argue that the economy wasn't well performing then, the richest 1% only took 8% of income growth. So there's certainly nothing inevitable about this. And there is a really interesting literature in economics that looks at the economic costs of inequality. First of all, there's a literature that looks at that at the firm level or the workplace level. And there's a literature in sociology or in organizational management that says the more unequal a workplace is, it undermines productivity. And similarly, you know, in the wake of the Occupy movement, you started to get economic warnings coming from some unlikely sources. It was coming up in Davos at the World Economic Forum. It was coming up from the governor of the Bank of Canada. It was coming up from the IMF. And in particular, what they were saying is there is evidence that more unequal societies have worse economic performance and more economic volatility than those societies that are more equal.
Okay, so inequality is there. But how does Canada rate with regards to other nations on inequality? For example, our Gini score. And for our listeners who don't know what the Gini score is, it's a measure of relative inequality within a nation. The lower the number, the more wealth is spread around. The higher the number, the more wealth is sort of concentrated. So I'm going to throw out some numbers here. You don't have to write them down, but you can check our website for the details. Our Gini score is 32 compared to the U.S., which is 41. South Africa is 67, highly inequality country. But other industrial nations like Germany is at 26. Sweden and Japan are at 25. The ratio of top 10% to bottom 10% of incomes in Canada is 9.2. Again, compared to the U.S., which is 15.9. South Africa, 33. But other industrial nations, Germany is 6.9, Sweden 6.2, and Japan 4.5. Essentially, I think these numbers show that other industrial countries have managed to have thriving capitalist economies and yet substantially more equitable when it comes to realizing the gains from that. So how do you think about how Canada rates in the world?
Well, not well. That's the short answer. When you look at how we compare, we certainly rank above the OECD average in terms of those Gini scores that you just mentioned. In fact, so within all the OECD industrialized countries, Canada ranks poorly, about 24th out of 34 countries. And we used to be in the middle. We used to be at 14th. Now, is the United States more unequal? Yes. But we have nothing to be smug about there because inequality has been growing more quickly in Canada than it has in the United States in recent years. And that's something that both the OECD and the Conference Board of Canada have noted.
You've kind of mentioned this already before, but let's just put it out there. So what does inequality mean to Canada and how does it affect our country?
Well, yeah, I mean, in many respects, that this is really the crux of the matter, what you're now asking, because there's no disputing the increase in inequality. The question is, does it matter and are there consequences? And I would argue it does matter for a whole bunch of reasons. It's bad for the economy, first of all. It's harmful to social cohesion. It leads to a whole host of health and social problems. And I would actually additionally say it's bad for the environment and for climate. And it's also bad for democracy. I've already touched on why it's bad for the economy. And I would mention again on the social and health side, the work of Richard Wilkinson. He's plotted all of these industrialized countries and their level of inequality against a whole host of social and health problems, overall health, mental health, addiction, teenage pregnancy, homicide rates, and other forms of violence. Every one of those things, you see a strong correlation between the level of inequality in a society and all of these health and social issues that we all pay for. One of the things we do at the CCPA in our climate justice project is we're interested in the intersection between inequality and climate. And there, too, in work, original work that we've done, you see that GHG emissions are also closely tied to household income.
Just for our listeners, GHG, greenhouse gases.
Greenhouse gases. So in Canada, the wealthiest 20% of households have almost double the GHG emissions of the poorest 20% of households. You know, so the 1% are a climate problem on top of everything.
That's something I would not have necessarily thought of, but good point. Well, just to see if we can bring it right home. So is there any example you can give that would affect me? So if our listeners are out there and they're saying, inequality you've talked about, you know, it's this airy-fairy stuff out there, but they could look at their own life and say, right here, right now, I can see how inequality is somehow affecting my life. Is there any examples?
Well, let me elaborate a little bit more on what I think is the real significance of the Wilkinson work I was mentioning. So, for example, he finds this correlation between inequality and poor health. But importantly, it's not just the poor health of the poor. It's the poor health of everyone, right through the income gradient, as we call it in economics, right? So, meaning, if you are a wealthier person in the United States versus a wealthier person in Denmark, which has low inequality, the wealthier in the U.S. are also worse off. It's not just the poor. Meaning, we're all paying for this.
With all that stress of worrying someone might mug you.
Well, I mean, there's the mugging thing, but it's interesting you use the word stress, because as Wilkinson tries to explain this, the connection between health and addiction and mental health and all of this stuff, he does feel like a lot of this is rooted in a kind of psychosocial stress, is the language he uses, and that more unequal societies have that, and it's bad for our collective health.
Just to take a bit more in a different direction slightly.
By the way, he says, yeah. He has one other fascinating correlation, because when you're debating inequality with right-wingers or our friends at the Fraser Institute, they have another line, which is, it doesn't matter because of income mobility, which is to say, yeah, we have lots of inequality, but people are changing it up all the time. The poor today will be rich tomorrow, and the rich today will be poor tomorrow, and so we don't need to worry.
I think the Republican had a great line for this. There is the well-off and the soon-to-be-well-off.
That's right. There you go. But here's what's interesting about Wilkinson's work as well, which is he also plots inequality against mobility, because there's this whole literature that's existed in many industrialized countries that try to track over time how the income of a father it determines the income of a son. And what you find is that the more equal societies like Denmark and Norway also have more mobility. And the United States and the UK, in contrast, perform abysmally on mobility. And so Wilkinson and Pickett have this funny line, which is, if Americans really wanted to live the American dream of Horatio Alger, they should move to Denmark.
You know, it's funny because I was having a discussion with a friend of mine kind of about, you know, well, it's an equal system and everyone has their fair chance. And I'm reminded, because it's been in the news, the G20 that we had in Toronto, and how you had the masses of people attempting to have their voices heard being clubbed down and arrested, while the elites of our country, the lobbyists, were inside the G20 having dinner and talking to the politicians about quote-unquote real Canadian problems. And it just seemed to be such an unequal dichotomy there.
Yeah, and actually what you're saying now relates to the final cost, if you will, that I was mentioning earlier, which is the cost of democracy. Yeah, that in a more unequal society, it perverts people's feeling, and often for good reason, that we all have equal say in determining our collective decisions. And that is corrosive.
I think we kind of start off, we were talking about the Occupy movement and the rising identity of the 98%, and granted those percentages are a bit misleading. But one of the biggest things I think that come out of the movement is the difference between political engagement and civic engagement, where political engagement is sort of mediated and dominated by the party structure, lobbyists, and entrenched power structure. But civic engagement is largely free of that. It's mediated between individual citizens at the local level. What do you think about civil action? I mean, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives seems to be attempt to bridge these sort of two forms of engagements. Do you see them as sort of two things that are sort of separate and distinct, or more points on a spectrum?
Well, I see them separate and complementary. And to choose between them is a false dichotomy. I mean, ultimately, we need both. If political change was just something that happened at the partisan and electoral level, very little would happen. You know, that it's that civic engagement that creates political space and changes political culture and shifts the realm of what's possible. Conversely, if you only had that and never had a way of giving those desires political expression, very little would change. It takes both.
I think I agree. And again, I would like to call out that I think the work that you're doing in Policy Alternatives provides a sort of a political, a legislative sort of structure for a lot of things that people on the street or the normal people have as sort of an inkling. They feel that something needs to be changed, but they're not quite sure how to articulate it in a way that government can actually grab it and run with it. And you kind of provide that sort of hands-on for government to actually say, this is how we can actually do what these people want.
You know, what you just said is very similar to how I describe our work. I mean, ours is a political cultural project. But I often describe the work that we do is to show people that their best values are still possible. You know, most Canadians and British Columbians actually have pretty good values, and they do have a desire that we to take better care of one another and to rise to the challenge of climate change. But we have it beat into us that those values aren't realistic or realizable. And so our job is to equip people with the facts and the figures and the analysis that they need to say, that's not true. And to have the courage of their convictions to know that we can still achieve these things.
Well said. So what advice would you give to our listeners to keep informed and keep engaged in a civic society? I mean, one of the themes of our show is that in order to be a good skeptic is you need to be informed, you need to be educated about the thing you are talking about. How would you suggest, besides obviously visiting your websites, to do this? How do we get engaged?
Well, of course, they should join the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. And we're actually the only non-governmental think tank in the country whose single largest source of income is individuals. So we do rely upon that. But don't just join. Get on the email list and get all of our stuff as we're producing it and use it. Use it to engage your friends and your family and your coworkers in these discussions that we need to have about how we look after one another. I'm always heartened by the fact that people are seeking, that people are wanting to be active citizens in that way. They do seek this information out. You know, the CCPA, we had over 2.1 million publications downloaded off our website last year. People hunger for that kind of information in order to have those conversations. And we just hope to amp that up.
Very, very well said. And of course, just on a parting note of mine, that's one of the things I find very discouraging about a modern society is we seem to be discouraged from engaging in our civic society and our political. It's more about hockey than it is about the pipeline in the north in BC.
Yes. And yet that desire is there. We just published a report on the pipeline a month or so ago, and within 2 weeks it had been downloaded 12,000 times. So, and I think the playoffs had already started. So there you go.
So there is hope out there after all. Thank you again for your insight and information regarding about inequality. You've kind of given us a last message. Is there any last thing you'd like to say? This is the last time you're going to be on our show. Hopefully we'll be on again in the future. But
No, I think that about covers it.
I think so.
Thanks, Don.
You have yourself a very nice day, and thank you again for spending time with us at Radio Free Thinker.